just one thing, it would be. Stay tuned. Coming up, Heart of Mind featuring Marianne Williamson. Stay tuned.
Wasteful and useless in times like these. Gather myself around my faith, the light the darkness most fear. My hands are small, I know, but they're not yours, they are my own. But they're not yours, they are my own, and I am never broken. Poverty stole your golden shoes, it didn't steal your laughter, and heartache came to visit me, but I knew it wasn't ever after. We'll fight, not out of spite, but someone must stand up for what's right.
Greetings, everyone. You're listening to Heart of Mind Radio for the New Millennium. And I am so pleased to be joined by Marianne Williamson. Marianne Williamson is a successful entrepreneur, best-selling spiritual and political author, political activist, and globally influential spiritual thought leader. For over three decades, she has been a leader in spiritual and progressive circles. She is the author of 15 books, four of which have been number one New York Times bestsellers. Williamson also founded Project Angel Food, a nonprofit organization that has delivered more than 16 million meals to ill and dying homebound patients since 1989. The group was created to help people suffering from the ravages of HIV/AIDS. She has worked throughout her career on poverty and anti-hunger and racial reconciliation issues. In 2004, she co-founded the Peace Alliance to support the creation of a U.S. Department of Peace and has hosted the Sister Giant Conference that have educated and encouraged thousands of women throughout the country to engage in political activity. The pillars of Williamson's presidential campaign are the restoration of America's middle class through fundamental economic reform. She supports an economic bill of rights, including universal health care, tuition-free college and tech school, and a guaranteed living wage. The establishment of a Department of Peace and the Department of Children and Youth. The declaration of a climate emergency to mass mobilize for the development of a green energy grid. And ending America's drug war. Williamson believes the transformation of American society requires that we address the root cause of our problems and not only their symptoms. The basis of her campaign is an agenda for an economic U-turn, a return of power from the hands of a small corporate elite to the average citizen of the United States. If elected, Williamson will be the first female, the first mother, and the first grandmother to be president of the United States. And you can find more about her work and her campaign at Marianne2024.com. That's Marianne2024.com. So I just want to thank you so much for joining us today. We are a radio station that cares about the world, cares about people, and cares about bringing forth voices that are voices for change and transformation of the world that we're living in. So I would like to invite you to share a little bit about yourself, maybe I didn't cover, but also how you made that transition from community healer, community activist into a more present voice in the political scene. Why is it important for someone who is working on healing to be in the political world?
You know, when I was in college, we used to read Ram Dass and Alan Watts in the morning. And then in the afternoon, we would go to Vietnam anti-war rallies. When I was growing up, there weren't these separate categories and separate lanes. It was a huge countercultural revolution. It was everything. It was the music. It was sex. It was politics. It was spirituality. It was culture. There wasn't a sense that there were these particular lanes and you were in one or the other. It was really a more of a sense then of a kind of holistic, whole person, whole world transformation that was occurring. So this is really a kind of modern, and I think kind of aberrational chapter in which we think there are these categories of experience. That's not what human beings are. We're whole people. We go to therapy and we're community activists. You know, it's like, it's not, this is an artificial way, I think, that is used to kind of make some people stay away from conversations that the establishment doesn't find them, if the establishment within that sector doesn't find them convenient. So I did feel for a very long time that the greatest contribution I could make would be the aspect of personal healing because of my interest in A Course in Miracles, and my life just went that way. It wasn't like I wasn't interested in politics. It wasn't like I was, you know, didn't do my part to the best of my ability, because I did. But the way my own career unfolded, I was addressing internal issues, spiritual transformation, et cetera. My own father had said to me at one point at the beginning of my career, what happened to you? He said, I raised you to wage the revolution. I said, I think it is the greatest revolution, Daddy. It's the revolution of love. What happened to me, however, was that at around the year 2000, sort of the late 1990s and into the early 2000s, I began to meet people in my work who were in crises that were systemic, that needed a lot more than spiritual counseling or therapy. What they needed was the ability to live on just one job. What they needed was health care. What they needed was safer neighborhoods. And I began to realize that the system itself had become abusive. The system itself, and that the same principles that prevail within our own individual lives also prevail within a group, because a group is just a group of people. So if you and I have to be more loving, more forgiving, more generous, not hypocritical, and standing on principle in order for our lives to thrive, so does a country. And I saw my country become, over the years of my growing up, something that in many ways I can hardly recognize. So I don't feel I transitioned from one area to another. I simply transitioned from applying a set of principles to the individual to also applying them to the collective. But they're the same principles. I'm not talking about anything different. I'm talking about being loving. So if you have 39% of Americans who are now skipping meals in order to pay their rent, I think that is a spiritual issue, that people are going hungry in the richest country in the world. Something is morally off, spiritually off, and needs to be addressed in something other than just the most crass political terms.
I so agree with you. And I grew up through some of those outside the boundaries living structures. I grew up in the South Bronx in New York City, which was always very struggling in a way. But what I found to be the thing that really helped to uplift me was beginning with a spiritual understanding, you know, which my mother gave to me, but understanding that being spiritual, and whether it's faith or whether it's just spirituality, that there needs to be a bridge gap between the personal and the social, between how I might improve my life and how I can improve everyone's life. And that's what I really love about your work, is that you have been able to translate that inner calling to something that everybody can relate to based on just the issues of our lives. But I'm wondering if you could speak to, for a moment, to those people who are kind of inwardly gazing at their navels and think about what they can do to take responsibility for transforming the world. One thing is to look at candidates such as yourself, but how should they begin to approach their life in their world right now?
I think what we're supposed to do becomes obvious to us once we're clearer about who we're supposed to be and why we're on the earth. You're here to love and be a vessel of love. Once you get that, once you get, you know, that the only purpose of your life is for it to have meaning, for it to be a vessel of love and transcendence and enlightenment and service, then duh, you don't need me to point out to you children are starving. You don't need me to point out to you, like I said, 39% of Americans are, you know, skipping meals, or over a million people are rationing their insulin, or people living on the street, 600,000. There is suffering all around us. It's, you know, what you are supposed to do. You know, when Mahatma Gandhi was asked who is the leader of the Indian independence movement, he said the small, still voice within. I mean, no matter where we are, no matter what neighborhood, there is suffering around us. Address it. Now, whether that means your main area is the environment, or your main area is domestic abuse, or your main area is children, your main area is the economy or healing, use your life for some purpose larger than your own. You know, young women used to say to me all the time, how do I find my power? And my answer was always, use your power on behalf of someone else. That's how you find your power. So I think that once you have that sort of amazing grace moment, I was blind and now I see. Once you realize the society works in such a way to keep us blind, because a certain level of even consumerism is based on I need this constant machinery of what I think I need. And when all of my attention is on what I need, then it becomes easier to forget what other people need.
Mm, very true. I'm looking at your webpage, Marianne2024.com. And as I look at the issues, there's probably, or maybe more than I can even count in this space. So I want to be able to focus in on some of them. And one of the things I remember from the last campaign was that you were, I believe, the only candidate that was really looking at issues, say, such as reparations, such as water safety. And I know that we're broadcasting on World Water Day, and I know that you were connected to the issues in Flint, Michigan. So I'm wondering if you can speak on some of these kind of issues that don't usually come to the fore.
Well, first of all, we should point out that the Flint, Michigan crisis has really never been solved. And that basically what officialdom has done in Michigan is, and this is how the world works now, if they don't solve it, they pretend they did. And of course, a lot of the problems in Flint, Michigan, you also have in Jackson, Mississippi, Newark, New Jersey. We have 40s and the whole issue of lead pipes, the whole issue of water contamination is at this point ubiquitous. And 46% of America's urban water wells are filled with PFAS, these forever chemicals. And in terms of, you know, a state like Texas is running out of water, period. So the aquifer's drying up. You know, if there's, I don't think there is a more dramatic sign of the fact that the climate crisis is already not only upon us, but already creating these rolling disasters. You know, for those of us who have grandchildren, I remember when I was in college, I remember hearing somebody say, one day they're going to be fighting wars over water. And I remember thinking, oh, that's ridiculous, you know. But now it's not a ridiculous idea. And I think that the issue becomes whether it's climate or anything else, the shift that has to occur within us to realize the level of permanent crisis and genuine disaster that is already upon us. And if we do recognize it, I do believe we have what it takes to rise to the occasion. I don't go from there to a cynical acquiescence to the idea that there's nothing we can do. But it's like that James Baldwin quote, right? Not everything that is faced can be fixed, but nothing can be fixed that isn't faced. And I think that's where we are with water and so many things, that if we don't, that we are led by official voices that would rather deny a problem than actually solve it, if solving it would undercut the corporate bottom line that is their donor base. It's a deeply corrupted system.
Yeah, and that's going to be a real challenge no matter how you look at it. So I'm wondering, given how much money is being spent on foreign catastrophes, how can we shift all those dollars into repairing what's happening here in the United States? And I see problems being exacerbated in the country as a way of distracting people from looking at what the real problems are, which, as you stated, is the organization, the corruption in our government agencies and policies and leaders at the current time. But I can't help imagining how that money could be spent right here in the United States. And I was wondering if you could give some feedback on that.
There's this narrative that's been created that the fact we're not spending money on our people in this country is because we're spending it on foreign wars. That's just not, I mean, we can have our own things about foreign wars, there are issues, but that's that narrative simply doesn't align with what's actually happening. We are not taking care of the American people for two reasons. Number one, because the elite really don't want to. Our modern capitalist system is such a malevolent strain that it's actually predicated on the existence of a permanent underclass. Mm. So it's not that the money isn't there. That's not how money works on a federal level. There's a choice. It's an ideological choice to hold the money in the hands of a very small group of people. We have had over the last 50 years a $50 trillion transfer of wealth into the hands of 1% of Americans, because that is the people who did that. It is their ideological perspective that an oligarchy is better than a democracy. They honestly believe that a small group of people who have wealth and have more opportunity to create wealth should be calling the shots. And with greater opportunity comes greater leverage. They don't want everybody to have leverage. You could stop all the foreign. Look, we weren't in those foreign wars when Donald Trump was here. He wasn't spending it on the people. that's not what it's about. It's about the fact that there has been a massive theft. And so now if people are worrying, well, I don't have money for health. You know, they're not spending money on health care. They're not spending money on tuition free college and tech school. They're not spending money on subsidized child care. They're not spending money on paid family leave. It's not because of foreign wars, which is not that I'm justifying or defending foreign wars. You know, that's not what this is about. But it's because, number one, they're slashing taxes on the very, very richest Americans, spending the money on huge subsidies, multi-billion dollar subsidies on companies that are already making multi-billion dollar profits, and their actual ideological belief that property rights are more important than people. And they honestly believe in a system in which property rights, and property rights by definition for a kind of new aristocracy, that they honestly, they don't like democracy. I mean, that element, and that element holds so much power, is not really dedicated to democracy. And that's really, this is not about where we spend our money. It's about democracy versus genuinely anti-democratic forces. You know, in my campaign over the last year, I always go back to the Declaration of Independence, because the Declaration of Independence is our mission statement. If you're going to say all men are created equal, if you're going to say all men have inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, if you're going to say governments are instituted to secure those rights, and the people have the right to alter or abolish that government if it's not doing its job, that's the ideal. That's the mission statement. That's the North Star. But when the Declaration was signed, 41 out of the 56 signers were slave owners. So that dichotomy has always been with us. It's who we are. We're both and. We've always been both and. We are a country in every generation, from the beginning and even including in yours and mine, filled with people who get the bigness of that vision, the extraordinary possibilities for humanity, people who have struggled for it, have sacrificed for it, and have died for it. And then there have always been, from the very beginning, from slavery, even unto now, people who, for their own ideological and or financial purposes, had absolutely no intention of seeing those principles actualized, and would do whatever it could, they needed to do, to make sure that they were not. That then the American story over time, that struggle is reiterated in every generation, some more dramatically than others. But if you look at our history, other generations rose up and repudiated that. We answered slavery with abolition. We answered the institutionalized oppression of women with the women's suffrage movement. We answered the first Gilded Age with the establishment of organized labor. And we answered segregation with the civil rights movement. And now it's our turn. And it's not a specific institutional reality at this time. It's an economic paradigm. It's the idea that corporate profits, short-term corporate profit maximization for insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, big food companies, big agriculture companies, big chemical companies, gun manufacturers, big oil and defense contractors, that their profits should come before the safety, health, and well-being of the American people. And we have to stand up in our time, and we have to resist it in our time. But it's the same phenomenon. It's no different. It's people who believe in a soulless system by which somebody's property is more important than your life. And That's, you know, this idea of it being about foreign wars. I mean, foreign wars definitely is an issue because a lot of that has to do with profit for defense industry. But I think we're missing it if we think that, I mean, it's also why 75 to 90 million people don't have health insurance or are underinsured. It's why 1.3 million people ration their insulin. That's all because of insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. It's why we have carcinogens in our food that they don't have in other advanced democracies, because of big food companies, chemicals in our pesticides that we know harm a child's brain. It's why our streets are flooded with guns because of gun manufacturers. It's why no matter who they are, Democrat or Republican, those guys stand in line with big oil. And then, of course, the wars. Mm-hmm. So there's an awakening, I believe. And from running this year, I do believe that awakening is happening. I do believe it. But the political system that should be a conduit for the awakening is actually, it acts like a suppressant. It's not the channel for the will of the people as it is supposed to be. It's actually a lid that sits on top of the full expression of the will of the people. And that's a serious, serious problem.
And I do believe you're right. And so many of us are struggling under the weight of that, but don't know how to make a difference, don't know how to make that transition. And I see these so-called political parties just setting up distraction after distraction, attacking each other, calling people out, and trying to make kind of this delusional state in which the people who would be electing candidates are so confused. I feel confused. I don't really know what to do. I know that I can vote for a person that has a message that I believe in, but how do we really bring this together as a people in a movement that has strength that can go forward and build toward changing this?
Well, no one person can change it, but a president matters, and mm-hmm. a president would lay it down like this. And that's really what you just said is why I ran for president, because a presidential campaign is a way to harness that very energy. And I believe that, and that is why the system is so resistant to that. That's why, for instance, in my case, I was blacklisted from major media outlets, kicked off ballots, lied about, smeared, mischaracterized. Oh, they don't want anyone giving this message. So when you say, what do we do? Well, if you have someone running, don't be vulnerable to the misinformation. And if you feel that that person is standing for what you believe, then support them. Don't just complain. Support the person who you believe. You know, the levers of power matter. We can talk about it all we want. We can, you know, there are many outside dynamics. The labor movement is so important. Nonprofits are so important. But ultimately, so is electoral power. People who actually have the levers of power, whether it's president, Congress, or the Supreme Court for that matter. So I believe that it's so important, you know, for instance, the president has already won the delegates to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. I've been in the belly of the beast for this last year. I've seen how that has worked. I've seen how the DNC suppressed a campaign, a primary. They said there wouldn't be one because they had decided that we would not primary an incumbent. That's not how democracy works. It's not supposed to be theirs to decide. But they believe that the threat to democracy was so great that they had a right to suppress democracy in order to take it on. But the reason I'm still here, the reason I'm in Louisiana today, the reason I'll be in New York next week, is because the more votes that you can get for a candidate, even if they can't get delegates, the more the sign is, including to those who need to win in November, that somebody cares enough about these issues and this message, and maybe we better hear that if we want to win in November.
Well, I think you're so right about that. I'm glad that you brought that up, because that really does give people some responsibility on what they can do to make a difference. Because I've certainly decided that I'm not going the route of the existing parties. To me, it's like, do you choose death cult A or death cult B? I don't see any kind of movement to actually transform the world or help people or uplift people who are here really, really suffering, struggling to survive day by day. So I'm wondering if you could set that vision for us. What would your presidency be? How would you counter some of these problems?
We need an economic bill of rights. We need to handle this comprehensively. It can't just be tweaking things here and tweaking things there. So we need an economic bill of rights that includes an improved Medicare for all. And that would include eyeglasses, hearing aids, dental, and mental health. We need tuition-free college and tech school. And both of those they have in every other advanced democracy. We've been trained to expect too little. So we need tuition-free college and tech school. We need Medicare for all. We need a complete elimination of the college loan debt using the Higher Education Act. We need subsidized child care. We need paid family leave. We need guaranteed sick pay. We need guaranteed jobs, and we need a guaranteed living wage. In addition to that, we need to end America's war on drugs. We need a Department of Peace, because we need to wage peace. We need to play peace games, not just war games. We need a peace academy, not just a war military academy. We need armies of peace builders, not just armies of military personnel. We need a mass mobilization from a just transition from a dirty economy to a clean economy, just like we need to go from a war economy to a peace economy. And we need a Department of Children and Youth, because America's children are at unbelievable risk. We have millions of American children who go to schools where they don't even have the resources to teach a child to read. That's why they call it often the cradle to prison pipeline. If a child cannot learn to read by the age of 10, then the chances of incarceration are much greater, and the chances of high school graduation are drastically decreased. So that's the kind of thing that would be my agenda. And then, like you said, if you look at the issues section in 2024, you see so many things there. All the system now, we have a political system that's stuck in the 1990s, I think, definitely in the last century. And so they see it as a machine. They're just going to treat symptoms rather than root causes. We need a president who says we need to address root causes, and we need to address the overall dynamic. Are we economically committed at this point to liberty and justice for all? And I argue that we are not. So when you said that you are not going to go with one of the major political parties, I certainly understand that, although we shouldn't be naive enough to think that if someone is a third party, they're necessarily going to use the powers in any other way. We have to have a larger conversation even than just that. And I would hope that your listeners would say, well, even if I'm going to vote third party, Williamson, because she's running as a Democrat, that for this primary, would vote for me, because it will matter whether you end up voting third party or not. Mm-hmm. And voting third party is just so enormously expensive that, George Washington, when he, in his farewell address, warned us about political parties at all. He said that he feared they would form factions of men more loyal to their party than to their country. And that's definitely what has happened.
Yeah, I think finding myself confused when I think about, I find it difficult to support. I'm looking at the main contenders. I'm not looking at, the full spectrum of candidates. I think whether you vote for someone who's Democrat or Republican or independent at the primary level is where you have more power in that vote.
Yeah.
But I'm not, I think I'm so disappointed in the things that the Democratic Party has done in terms of not allowing people to challenge the top candidate. To me, that is a betrayal. And when I look at the kind of things that these parties are doing, I feel that they are betraying the whole democratic process and the whole constitutional process and really suppressing my voice. And that's why I think that many people have become, I just don't know what to do because I can't support this kind of behavior.
Well, believe me, I've been in the belly of that beast for a year, and I know what you're saying in every cell of my being. You're right. But we have till November to decide what to do in the general. And I would just hope that in the primary, people would know that, you know, voting for me is an act of resistance on that level.
Well, I agree with that for sure. And I think that that's it's an important voice, because as I look at all of the politics, I can see that there's beginning to be concern and worry at the top of the ticket. So when they had the contested vote, I think it was in Michigan, where people are like, no, actually, we're not going to support anyone, that kind of begins to have a powerful voice. So I do believe that voting for the candidate that you truly want to be in office is important at the start of this journey, because it does begin to expand the conversation of what happens at the end of that election road. So I agree with you there entirely. And I'm wondering if you could give us some insight also in, as the president, I would say, how will you be able to contend, and this is a issue now as you talked about, contend with the media and the corporate influence? Because I really think that that's something that's preventing anything from changing.
Well, I've learned from this experience that there is a political media industrial complex. And just as Fox works as a kind of shill often for the Republican Party, CNN and MSNBC are for the Democratic Party. For instance, this time I was completely blacklisted. They wouldn't have me on CNN at all. Even the last time I had a CNN town hall, this time MSNBC and CNN wouldn't even have me. It was totally about protecting the narrative, the DNC concocted narrative. There would be no one but the president. Even mainstream outlets saying he had no opponent, betraying in exactly the way you said. Now, as president, if I'm president, you know, in this very, very improbable scenario, but we need to envision, you know, your question is within that. The president does not have a magic wand, and we don't want the president to have a magic wand. We don't have a king. And what we have is three co-equal branches of government. But the president still has a lot of power. The president still has the power of the executive branch. So I would have the power to appoint, for instance, the people who head the agencies. And these agencies have been captured by corporate forces. It's called agency capture. These agencies, which were set up in order to advocate for the people in repudiation of any forces, corporate or otherwise, that would limit the power of the people, have in too many cases, what happens now is that the government enables those corporate forces. Right. And it's all because of the undue influence of money on our politics. So that's number one. I would have, as president, the power of the executive branch to fight on that level. Number two, as Franklin Roosevelt said, the main power of the presidency, the main job of the presidency, he said, is not administrative. It's moral leadership. The president has the bully pulpit. Imagine if we had a president who laid it down as real, as honestly, and as authentically as you and I have been talking about today. Imagine that. Imagine a State of the Union where we talk about the fact that 39% of Americans are skipping meals in order to pay their rent. Talk about the fact that half the people who are renting in America cannot afford their rent. Talk about the real issues on something other than the level of superficiality that now dominates our politics. And the president has the right every year to present a budget and present a vision. Now, you no matter who you are, no matter whether you're Donald Trump or Joe Biden or myself, you hope that your House and Senate are going to be of your party. And you may be yes and maybe no. But the larger conversation that I believe needs to be had from the executive branch at this point is an awakening of the people and truth telling to the people. And that's why I believe my presidency would be important.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it also begins to set a dynamic of how people can look at all of the representatives in the Congress and the Senate, as well as the presidency, as a way of defining what values are important and need to be upheld. So ultimately, were you to be in the White House, people would still need to be vigilant to make sure that their representatives are doing the right thing. And I would say, in either case, whomever is in the White House, there needs to be that kind of vigilance. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that in terms of, I feel that in measure what you're doing is you're building a movement of consciousness.
And a coalition of conscience, as Martin Luther King would call it. What you're saying is extremely important. And I would add to that, vigilance not only in terms of their congresspeople and their senators, but also vigilance in terms of their local and state government. I have said throughout the year, I don't want to go to Washington and fight for you. You know, that's what the traditional politician says. Make me president or I can go to Washington and fight for you. Well, that's not my idea of a good time. I want to go to Washington to co-create with you a new chapter in American history. But especially now, the same forces that need to be rejected and repudiated in Washington have to be rejected and repudiated in Albany, have to be rejected and repudiated in Sacramento, have to be rejected and repudiated in Austin and in our local communities. The only way we're going to, at this time, be able to cut the cord with an aberrational chapter of American history in which oligarchy has literally found a way to replace democracy is if all of us change inside as well as outside. You know, Martin Luther King said, we need external changes in our circumstances and internal shifts in our souls. We have to have a characterological shift where all of us, not just in the political field, this whole idea, there's a political class, they concocted that. That's not what was supposed to happen here. All of us have to wake up in the morning and recognize that in order to live a well-lived, meaningful life, we have to become vessels of transformation on the outside as well as the inside. And, you know, we don't even, first of all, that kind of monopolization of power has replaced local newspapers. So a lot of people don't even have access to what's going on in their local government. We have to start like attending things like city hall meetings. Look how the people on the right, they've been far more psychologically and politically strategic. They've been going after school boards. They've been going after state legislators. So the vigilance of which you speak, I would submit, we have to, if we want awakening, you can't, you know, and one of the mistakes we've made on the left, we made it with Clinton, we made it with Obama. Oh, we elected the right guy, so we can go back to our lives. That age has got to be over. Over. The power is only, the only safe repository for power is in the hands of the people. So I think, you know, maybe there are people listening right now who had never really thought about running for state office or local office, but that's got to be part of the regreening. And it's going to take 10 to 20 years, but we can get started.
I was just going to ask that question. How do you see that road going forth and how long might it take? But I think it's important that we start walking that path for sure. And
look, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. And I was just going to say that this is a first step.
Yep. Well, yeah. You know, you've got to just take the first step. So we're right now, we're headed for the iceberg. The iceberg could be nuclear. The iceberg could be environmental. There are so many ways that this thing could blow on a global scale beyond anything we could absorb. Okay. The Republicans are just speeding right to the iceberg. The Democrats are moving more slowly and would hit it at a different angle. We have to be committed. No, we're going to turn this ship around. I feel in my 4 years as a president, I could get us around the curve. Just get us around the curve. Then you hand it to a younger generation to take it from there. But we've got to be committed. We're turning this around, and don't expect them to do it. The governments, the status quo is now such that our government has become a system of legalized bribery. That system is not going to disrupt itself. It's we the people have to do it now. And that's going back to the Declaration of Independence. We the people, if the government's not doing its job, it's the right of the people to alter it or abolish it. We've been trained to expect too little. It's been a trained powerlessness. It's what's happened to us. You know, I say to audiences, I'll say, when it comes to your personal life, you're probably very smart. And you're probably all into analyzing the psychological dynamics, and you don't stand for abuse, and you set boundaries, and you don't do toxic relationships. What could be a more toxic relationship than that they're allowing carcinogens in your food that you're feeding your children that they wouldn't have in other advanced democracies? What could be a more abusive relationship than that you are denied healthcare when they have it in every other advanced democracy? But when it comes to our collective experience, we've been trained to think like sixth graders. We've been trained to give up our power. We've been trained to just acquiesce with our own critical thinking. You saw it all this year. If you were a Democrat, it will be Joe Biden. It will be Joe Biden. It will be Joe Biden. And to look at anyone else as a spoiler, like you forgot seventh grade civics. It's a primary. You got to take, we can't take our country back until first we take our minds back. And we have to take our hearts back. You don't let children go hungry. You don't do that. You're diminishing your own humanity. And so I think there's an internal awakening that precedes the kind of political transformation we need. Now, I do want to say this. I think it's happening. Everywhere I go, I think the American people, we've been through COVID, we've been through Trump, we've been through 9/11, we've been through January 6th. We have matured. I think, you know, I always say to audiences, we all know, we've been saying it for years, there's something very tragic about what happens when a child is never allowed to be a child. But there's also something pathetic about an adult who never bothers to grow up. Mm. This is not a time for men who act like little boys and women who act like little girls. This, and I think, you know, people hear you at the level you speak to them from. I think the American people are ready. We were born out of a great idea. Americans do great things. I think we're like wilted plants because nobody's asking us to do a great thing, because the political establishment doesn't want us to do a great thing because they've got a great thing going on for themselves. And I believe that what we need is leadership. What we need is someone to say, no different than the abolitionists, no different than the women's suffragists, no women than the early, different than the late early labor organizers, no different than the civil rights movement. We have got to say what is happening is not tolerable. And it will not continue on our watch. And we have to have the same fierceness that they had. And we have to say what was, it will not be any longer. And we're going to go in a different direction now. And if enough of us really get there inside ourselves and stop pretending that we have no power and start supporting someone who is saying that or people who are saying that and doing that, we'll be fine. But we don't have much time left. I'll tell you, we better get to it now.
Well, I so agree with you on that. There's not a lot of time, but I think that the message you're bringing is very important, because just myself personally, when I was speaking of, I didn't want to go in either direction. It's so easy to give up. and not want to involve oneself because it seems so futile. And I think that the message that you're bringing is to get people off their chairs and get them thinking and moving and beginning to understand, okay, like you said, civil rights wasn't won in a day. Women's vote wasn't won in a day. But this is something where we have to really make the statement now through our votes and keep on moving as we go forward to something better. So I know we've been talking for this hour. I want to make sure you've been able to share everything that you wanted to share.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, my website is marianne2024.com. That's M-A-R-I-A-N-N-E. And I will be in New York. I'm in Louisiana now, but next week, starting on Wednesday, for about 4 or 5 days, I will be various places in New York. I hope people will come out and hear me. And I hope people will understand the value of voting for this message in the primary. The fact that the president has won the primary in terms of delegate count does not mean that these votes do not matter. And I was really honored to speak with you today because I think, you know, Martin Luther King said your life begins to end on the day you stop talking about things that matter. And I think that our popular culture, including our political culture, is so dominated by things that are ultimately unimportant. And it's an institutional distraction technique. And I just am so moved and grateful for any opportunity such as we had here today, but to have conversations about things that matter. And I hope I'm heard when I say, I'm telling you, I see it all over this country. There's a reflectiveness. There's a depth of listening. There's a deep concern. We all have to come out of our silos now. And sometimes, you know, our race, our religion, our sex, our sexuality, our particular age group, you know, we do have to pay particular attention to our individual identities. But I think very important right now at this time in our history is that all of us come out of our silos and also have an American conversation. I always say, if you're 18 or if you're 80, I'm talking to you. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? You're one of the adults at this time. And, that's where the unity has to start. And I'm so moved being out there, whether, you know, I was in New Orleans last night, you know, I've been recently, California, Michigan, Georgia, Washington State, so many places. And I'm telling you, I see it everywhere. You know, one of the things I was saying last night, you know, people say they find this time traumatizing. I said, do you think the people who walked across the bridge at Selma were not traumatized?
Very good point.
Can we grow up and toughen up? Toughen up, buttercups. And you know what? When I say that, I feel audiences appreciate it. We have to remind each other. We have to just throw some water on each other's faces right now. Get up. I always say pray in the morning, kick ass in the afternoon. We got to do this now, and I don't think we can feel good about ourselves if we don't.
That's wonderful. And people can find out more about your events.
Yes.
By going to your website.
Yes, thank you. If you go to marianne2024.com, you'll see it there at the events drop down on the menu. And then also if they follow me on any of my social media, they'll see the announcements. Yes.
Very, very good. And I encourage everyone to get involved. And I thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's been an honor talking to you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now. I'm Catherine Davis. This is Heart of Mind. And I want to share a very special event coming up very soon. I will be there. And I hope that you will be there as well.
Join us for Earth Day and promote world peace and unity at Planet Heart's 16th annual World Peace Earth Day celebration, themed Awakening Humanity's Consciousness for a Better Planet. It's a spiritual community gathering, honoring Mother Earth, featuring insightful talks, uplifting music, sound healing, indigenous ceremonies, and more. That's Sunday, April 21st, 3 p.m. sharp to 6:30 p.m. at the Church of the Village, 201 West 13th Street in New York City. For tickets and info, visit www.planetheart.org or call 212-222-5432. That's 212-222-5432.
Everybody got to learn how to coexist and how to stop resisting. Yeah, cause we are the ruler of this new world.
I'm not right. You're not wrong. We both know what this love of ours is built upon. We are shadows, tiny sparrows, safe inside the clear blue sky of another stone.